We are actually at a miracle point. We're at the last verse of the first chapter. So Bert's running out of verses to talk on in the first chapter. But just by way of remembrance, we are looking at the book. Our theme that we are looking at throughout the entire book is the idea that in it is the gospel of righteousness. It's being revealed. And God is revealing his righteousness to us. It's a book that deals with righteousness and how we have a right standing before God. That's the big theme. And it says it that the righteous shall live by faith. And that was sort of the hall water or the high water mark of verse 17. By way of review, just to remind us of what we've already talked about so far in the book. The book begins with a very, very long sentence. From verse 1 through verse 7 in the Greek, it is one continuous sentence. Now, in the NIV, in the New American Standard, I believe they break it up into four or five sentences. But actually, when Paul wrote it, it's one long run-on sentence. That's the way Paul likes to write. He loves to start putting ideas together, and they just flow one after another. In fact, he loves to be distracted. He'll say, these three things I have for you. One, two. And then he just goes off, and he never gets back to three. And you always wonder, what was the third thing that was on his mind? Because Paul just runs things on it. He's saying something that will flow, it'll bring a new thought to his mind. And he'll speak on the new thought. And sometimes he doesn't always get back to the original thought. But that's okay, because he was inspired by God. And God moves him in those first seven verses to lay out an intense introduction. Because most of the time you see, dear John, from Bert, in the subject. Or a memo, you know, from Bert to John, subject, type of thing. And Paul writes seven verses to introduce from Paul. And he lays out a long subject. He wants to know about who Jesus is. The righteousness of God revealed to us. To the saints in Rome, called beloved. These were the things we saw in the first seven. Then in verses 8 through 15, we saw the personal life of Paul. And we looked at how he poured his life and his passion. And we said we probably wouldn't see any more of the personal side of Paul until we get to chapter 16. So we spent a long time on that because we knew we were going to be a long time. We wouldn't see Paul's passion again. But we remind ourselves, and at the end of that, we saw three I am statements where he says, I am under obligation. He felt compelled to share the gospel. I am eager to come share it with you, and I am not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so he opens that way, and this is what the introduction is as we go verses 1 through 17. And we were now finishing up his first section when he's showing that the Gentiles, the pagan, those who don't know the Jewish law, if you will, that they are guilty before God, not because they don't know the law, but because they have denied who God is. That which was given to them and made visible through nature, through their own consciousness, they have suppressed the truth. And he has bombarded them with a series of things. And he says, for the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness. And we said ungodliness was this phrase that talked about how we view God. They have godlessness. And this word wickedness was what man does to mankind. So they are guilty both because of their proclamation who God is, as well as what they do to mankind. Because they suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what should be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain. For since the creation of the world, his invisible qualities, that is, his eternal powers, divine natures, have been clearly seen. We saw through creation. We saw through nature. We saw how God had made himself visible. Not necessarily understanding everything there is to know about salvation, but to at least know there's a God. And Revelation demands a response. If you respond to that, God will bring people across their path. It says, for although they knew God, they neither glorified God, nor did they give thanks. But in their thinking, they became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Though they claimed to be wise, they became fools, and they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for mortal man. This is what we looked at. We sort of summarized it this way. We said, these verses shows us how God gets angry. He gets mad. He gets concerned about mankind when we suppress truth. We saw that in verse 18. We saw verses 19 and 20 that evidences that he had given to us are ignored. though they are plainly made to us. And the result of verse 21, we don't honor God. And the result of not honoring God, his glory is given away. The result of those four things that caused God to get angry, we saw that God abandons them over to unrighteousness. Three times we saw in verses 18 through 24, they exchanged. They gave away that which was about God. So three times God gives them over. He gives them over to a body that's been dishonored, the passions that are unnatural, and finally to a depraved mind, to all types of unrighteousness. Now that's an outline, if you will, of what we've talked about to date. And we can look at it this way. Therefore, God gave them over to sinful desires. He gave them over to shameful lust. He gave them over to a depraved mind. For since they did not think it was worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, he gave them over to a depraved mind to do that which ought not to be done. They have become filled with every kind of wickedness. And then he gives 21 examples. Wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They are gossipers, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, boastful. They invent evil ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They are senseless, faithless, heartless, ruthless. That's where we left off last week. Now, just we talked about the first seven verses is actually one long verse. Verse 28 through 32 is one long sentence as well in the Greek. Paul is just rattling along as he's moving through these things. And what's fascinating is when you begin to think about this, that's a pretty phenomenal list of 21 items. And we talked about them. And last week, just as we came to the conclusion, I paused because I didn't want to take the time to tell the story, but I wanted to save it for today as by way of introduction. It was fascinating when Dr. R.H. Graves was there in Canton, China as a missionary at the turn of the 20th century. The Chinaman that he was working with came to him and says, "This Bible cannot be true." And he looked at him and says, "Why?" He says, "Because it is such an accurate picture of who we are today. It could not have been written 1,900 years ago. Somebody read our morning newspaper and wrote about us today." And because this is a picture of man without God. And it wasn't just because that's the way they're in China. Not because of the way they were in India. We talked about last week. This is mankind wherever he is. It could be in Latin America. It could be in the grand USA. It doesn't matter where you call home. Man without God sees these types of things. It was Paul drawing upon what he saw as the Greco-Roman civilization. But verses 29 through 31 sound like our evening news. I mean, we talked just 2 weeks ago about here they are. It's almost like a gun goes off. They open the door of Walmart and guys get trampled to death because people are in such a hurry to get to a gift. We talked about men shooting each other because their wives are arguing over a gift in Southern California there in Toys R Us. I mean, this is just a picture of where our society is. And while I believe it's a true statement, it's true throughout the ages because this is the very nature of those who have made God their enemy and who are enemies of God. The key point is that mankind gets carried away with his ability to lift himself higher than he should, to think higher about himself, and to suppress the truth about what can be known of God. And as a result of that, we have spent weeks, literally. We spent now 3 weeks. We could have spent almost a week on every word, but I didn't want to torture you. But the very sheer fact is this, that society is growing, in my opinion, evil, worse evil, every year. Year after year. More violent. Every day our newspapers report the skyrocketing rise in senseless vandalism, vicious, unprovoked attacks on innocent and hopeless people. The rise in child abuse. We talked about that last week. Here in the United States, the most likely day to die is your birthday. The day of your actual birth. The fifth largest reason for children dying
they're being killed by their parents.
That's pretty shocking. That's a United States statistic. We're not talking about some pagan, some third world nation. We're talking about this country that we live in. This gives you a picture of it. The shocking violence in our school. Do we need to talk about Columbine or VPI, Virginia Polytechnical Institute? The murders that went on. Just think about when you were in school. We never thought about that. I was worried about the teachers getting mad at me. I didn't worry about the teacher. Students shouldn't be in classes. I mean, it's fascinating. Josh McDowell published in his book about what our kids are going through today that when most of us went to school, we worried about the color socks we wore, would we have bubble gum or not, and what teachers would do to us. And today, they're worried about guns in school. They got metal detectors. It is a frightful place the kids are growing up in. We have a road rage that's out of control. When you see what's happening on our society and on our streets out there. When we used to think of churches as being a safe place. And last year in Colorado, remember right here at Christmas time when they came in and they started blowing everybody away and shooting the people in the churches? I think we may have grown smarter, but I don't think we've grown wiser. Professing to be wise, the scripture said, they became fools. Verse 32 is the last part of that sentence we pick up today. It says, although they know God's righteous decrees, that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these things, but they also approve of those who practice them. You see, we're not just talking about people who themselves go out this, but they actually start beating the bandwagon and trying to get others to join them. They approve of those. At the conclusion of his prosecution of the Gentiles, Paul offers this final word of condemnation. In verse 32, he points out that the unregenerate man is not content just to damn himself. He energetically involves others in his road to perdition. He gives hearty approval to those who like to practice sin. In almost every society of the world, I don't care where you go, I don't care which country it is, the things we talked about in verses 29 through 31 are usually on the laws as things that are illegal, things that are not condoned or desired by, quote, society. And yet we tend to move away from those laws. We tend to say, well, that's those puritanical views of our past. We want to practice them. And it's this whole idea that those who are practicing them decide that they like their wickedness and they like to approve of their own wickedness and they want others to come along and partake with them. This is the pattern. Donald Barnhouse, in his commentary on the book of Romans, here in Romans 1, verse 32, says this is a damning text. This is a text that shows the promotion of wickedness is the final step in man's degradation and his rebellion against God. We talked about in those things, we saw that God had set up a society where he created, and he created an order. So we don't like the order. We don't like that children should be obedient to their parents. We rebel against our parents. Because that's part of the created order. We rebel against God because we don't like what God has done. We don't like what his nature and what his laws and his purposes are. Dr. Moo, writes it this way. He says, granted that condemning evil is not, in the ultimate sense, worse than doing it, it is also true that in a certain sense, the person who commits a sin under the influence of strong temptation is less irreprehensible than the one who dispassionately agrees with and encourages a sin for which he or she feels no strong attraction to him or herself. This idea that we want to encourage people to come practice sin is an amazing. Let's take apart like we've done today. We're going to go through verse by verse, actually word by word, through this thing. It starts off although. Literally, it can be translated who or which or whoever. The idea is that he's building. It's a continuation of what's going on here. Paul began the sentence back in verse 28, remember. As he's coming through here, this is just his transitional phrase. He wants to, although they know, this is not a debate. This is a word that literally means to know, to look upon, to witness, to reconcile, to recognize, to decide. They know God's righteous decrees. Those righteous decrees
these things here, these ordinances, these requirements, these things of righteousness. We know what the right standing is. The heathen knows what that God condemns the evil practices. And though these long lists of 21 items we've just gone through, we know that these vices and these vicious things were not committed in innocent innocence. These are the things the human being knows better. The reality is that God, even though they may have suppressed the knowledge of the truth, they know the truth, because you can't suppress that which you do not know. No? I give you an example. Do not think of a red-faced monkey. Now, you guys all thought of that red-faced monkey because I told you not to do it, but you could not not think about it without thinking about it. And that's the way we're wired. It's the way God makes us. They know the truth, and the reality of God and his revelation of his righteous wrath is evident. It's evident to them in creation. It's proclaimed to them. We're going to see Paul will continue this theme over in the second chapter in the 14th and 15th verse, sort of in a parenthetical statement. He reflects back on what he's already talked about. But since we don't know he's written it, I'm going to read it to you now, but I want you to catch the idea. He says, indeed, when Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature things required by the law, they are of the law for themselves, even though they do not have the law, since they show the requirements of the law are written on their hearts. Their conscience is also bearing witness, and their thoughts now accusing them, now even defending them. You see, the law is not something that the Hebrews learned in the Ten Commandments. It's written in their hearts. You get the idea here? They know what is the law of God. They know the debt law. They know the commandments. Thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not. Thou shalt not. They know these things. They're innate within them, but they suppress them and they become a law to themselves. They say, no, 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 no. In addition to natural revelation and our consciousness, we're not going to allow that. We're going to suppress that. We know it's true. We know it's worthy of death. But we know. We have a moral sense, and we're capable of knowing the will of God. And we can arrive at it by our own reason, that is from nature, and through our own consciousness, and through the depravity that when we practice and do these things, we know it's not good for us, but we're going to suppress those things. We're going to put it away because we will not admit. Now notice, God gives or turns an individual over to a depraved mind. They're not losing their knowledge of what's right and wrong. God just removes the conviction that it's wrong. They know it's wrong. They just don't want to deal with it because they've seared their consciousness, Paul will write to Timothy. They've come to a point in time where they just don't care. Like Eve in the Garden of Eden, who stood there seeing God's good gifts, she came to the conclusion, wrongfully, but she concluded that God didn't love her. He was withholding good things from her, that she had to partake of the fruit that God had told her not to touch. Actually, he didn't tell her not to touch it, remember? I was playing with your heads. He told her not to eat it. But she decides, he said, not to touch it. She adds to God's laws. God never said not to touch it. He said, you touch all you want. Just don't partake in it. Though men know better, they believe the lie. Remember we talked about that earlier in the text? We said it's translated, they believed a lie. It's actually the definitive article. It's the lie, the big one. That God does not love them. They believe that lie. And so therefore in willing ignorance, or so they train to claim it's willful ignorance, because the cost of belief, they say, is just too high. And yet the cost of unbelief is phenomenally high. As we look and see, this word that gets translated, the Diakonos talks about the ordinances and requirements. This is the same word that gets translated righteousness earlier when it says the righteousness of God is revealed. And it's the word that deals with this here. It's the irremutable grand rule of righteousness that God has revealed in every man. The knowledge of which God has, more or less, given to every nature of the world. Remember in the Truth Project, when we looked at that, he called it the imago Deo, the image of God. Seeing what has come into being, to honor our parents, to care for our offspring, to keep our commitments. These are things that you ask people walking down the street. You say, do you think it's right to keep your commitments? The average guy on the street is going to say, Well, why, yes. Do you?
No, but I know I should. Do you think it's right to honor your parents? Well, yes. Do you? Don't bother me with those issues. You're getting personal, Bert. You're meddling now.
As I told you last week, I don't apologize for meddling. I think it's good to meddle. I think it's healthy to provoke you to righteousness. Hence, their outrageous conduct was not due to a total ignorance of God, nor was it an ignorance of what God required, but it was due to their own willful self-rebellion. This is the court case Paul is laying out here. He's the prosecuting attorney, and he's declaring them unrighteous, guilty, without excuse, the text read earlier, and back in verse 20. People who do not recognize God because they refuse to recognize him. It's not that he couldn't be made known. They distinctively, in verse 18, were told to suppress the truth. And then listen to the stern words that Jesus says. We talked about this last week over in John 3. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe stands condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of God's one and only Son. This is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but men love darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. That's Jesus talking to Nicodemus. Pretty stern words. They suppress the truth. They deny what is going on because they do not want to admit that God has a right to affect their lives. And they know, the text tells us, that those who do such things deserve death. They understand it. The word here, very long Greek phrase. But basically it says, you were to try to sense it, because those who do such things, they are worthy to go to death. That's a literal wordy translation of it. The decrees of God condemn such sinners to death. The word death is used in the scriptures, denotes punishment, denotes separation from God. It does not mean that they deserve capital punishment, but rather that they are deserving of a judgment greater than that, if you will. Capital punishment just destroys the body. They're being removed totally from the presence of God, because God is holy and God is righteous. And they are not righteous. They are not holy. We look at passages in the scriptures that talk about death being spiritual separation from God. You see passages like over in John 8:51. It says, I tell you the truth, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death. But we know we don't keep his words. Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin, and in the same way death came to all men because all sinned. For before the law was given, sin was in the world. But sin is not taken into account when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking a command, as did Adam, who was a pattern of the one to come. But the gift is not like the trespass. For if many died by the trespass of one man, how much more did God's grace and the gift that is given by grace of one man, Jesus Christ, overflow to many. Again, the gift of God is not like the results of one man's sin. The judgment follows one sin and brought condemnation, but the gift follows many trespasses and brought justification. For if by the trespasses of the one man, death reigned through one man, how much more were those who received God's abundant provision of grace and of his gift of righteousness reign in life through the one man, Jesus Christ. Consequently, just as the result of one trespass was condemnation for all men, so also the result of one act of righteousness was justification that brings life for all men. For just as though the disobedience of the one man, the many were made sinners, so also the disobedience of one man, the obedience of one man, the many were made righteous. This will be Paul's summary when he comes to the end of this discussion. I want you to see. We're starting the introduction. He's saying man is guilty. He's unrighteous. But he comes to the conclusion, we can be made righteous in Christ Jesus. Because we're either going to be separated under righteousness,
or to be separated under unrighteousness. And in the path to that, he says, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And they ultimately conclude that the wages of sin is death. This is his first six chapters. We're just getting started. We've taken a long time to get to this introduction. But as he lays it out for us, he wants us to understand that we're separating it. The text says that although they know his righteous decrees, consistent with the view that this word means a righteous decree, denotes the sentiment of God that they deserve death. This word, diakama, does not mean his inflictions, but rather his statutes or his precepts. It means that God has given us a mind that's able to discern, but they have a depraved mind. God's saying to them, almost in irony, you don't like my way of thinking, and I'm going to give you over to your way of thinking. Your way of thinking is depraved. It's not righteous thinking. And we said it was diakamas. That's what we saw here for this reason. You could translate it depraved. It's not righteous in our thinking. All sinners are aware of this. It's amazing how, though they are aware of it, they suppress the truth. Amazingly. You know, even the heathen moralists, when you talk to them, they'll, I know it's morally right. I just don't agree with it. It's an interesting construct. People know what truth is, but they refuse to deal with it. It's not an issue. And the text continues, they not only continue to do these very things. It's the worst state of hedonism. The great principle of God is acknowledged, but it's a prevalence of the corruption of their heart that really bothers them. They know the righteous decrees. They acknowledge it. They acknowledge they're disobedient to it. They acknowledge it that it's worthy of death, yet they continue to practice it. And worse, as we've already talked about this morning, they're going to encourage others to join them on the road to perdition. I guess misery loves company. The old phrase was said. They approve of those who come after them. It's an interesting phrase. We see it over here that they approve. This word Allah, it starts off here. It's a word but or rather or to the contrary. They approve. This pseudodulogos. We see the phrase here. So also you testify who approve to what you or forefathers does. They kill the prophets, and you build their tombs. We see here with Paul, who's at this time was called Saul of Tarsus, he was there at the stoning of Stephen. It says he approved of these things. The same word that's used here. He gave condolences. He gave his blessing. He encouraged them. He writes to the Corinthians, to the rest I say this, I, not the Lord, if any brother has a wife who is not a believer, and she is willing, and is, she's approved, she's giving her approval to live with him, he must not divorce her. This whole idea of having it's a verb that comes in of hearty approval. It comes in late in the Greek language. It comes in about the time of Paul. It was a new word at the time. But there was this idea of absolute heart-wrenching approval. Not just intellectual approval, but the emotion of what's going on here. In this phrase, we see the extreme of sin. They're applauding it. They're clapping it. They're saying, we approve of sin with our heart and our mind. What's going on here? They gladly associate with the transgressors. They approve of those who committed sins. The text continues, who practice sin. The last two phrases that we've looked at this morning reveal to us the highest degree of wickedness. We see here persons are hurried by their own passions to do the things that they hate. But not only do they hate them, but they actually begin to approve it, and then they encourage others. This is the part that just absolutely amazes me, as this text says. The bottom of this wicked pit of depravity, of degradation, of sin, we find men's pursuit. And yet man says he's onward, upward, climbing to greatness. But the scriptures tell man is not evolving. He's devolving. He's going down. Their eagerness to encourage others in their commission of the same damnable sins that they are committing demonstrates that they understood. They're worthy of death, but they're encouraging others to come practice death. It's like, I love playing Russian roulette. Would you come join me? In fact, I want to encourage you. Why don't you go first? Because I won't be around to encourage others if I go first.
This whole idea to justify their own sin is bad enough, but to encourage others to practice it. John Murray, the great theologian of the end of the 19th century, put it this way. To put it bluntly, we are not only bent on damning ourselves, but we are congratulating others in their doing of those things we know have the issue in damnation. We hate others as we hate ourselves and render therefore to them the approval of what we know merits damnation. Our modern culture says, be tolerant, sanction, encourage this type of behavior. After all, who does it bother? Let me answer the question. It bothers society. It suppresses the truth of God. It removes from us our moral consciousness. It removes from us an understanding that we're fallen from God. And we begin to practice that. There's a very long quote that's going to be on the next three slides, but I thought it was very well translated. It was written by a German in German in 1815, if I remember correctly. And it says this way, since Paul speaks of the natural man disarranged from God, his description of morals also fits the generation of our day. Now, he's writing about 1815, if I remember correctly. One cannot better characterize the religious and moral condition of our civilized world than in the words of the apostle. It is God-forgetting, idolatrous generation which lives upon the earth, who gives thanks, who thanks God for his goodness, to which men owes the life and all blessing. The religion, the pseudo-religion of the world, is the deification of the creature. The world deifies her great men, her heroes, deifies herself, her own power, wisdom, excellence, and achievements. The philosophical confrontation and the adoration of God are nothing else than changing God into the image of weak mortal men. Man views God and divine things according to human standards. The generation of this age is an adulterous one. The world feasts her eyes upon the delights in the lust of the flesh, shame, and filthiness. Man's carnal desires are no longer satisfied by common adultery, but long for the unusual, the refined enjoyment, the unnatural, the unchaste of the apostles' time have today only assumed another form and appearance. It is a murderous generation in which we live. Avarice, insatiability, envy, in the mainspring of commercial life. Man has no consideration for his neighbor. Everyone strives to rise in the world and thus ruin and tramples upon others. It is his idle scorn and mockery of the world writes humanitarianism or universal love upon her standard. And from this streams of destruction rushes incessantly forward. One can no longer check and restrain this disgraceful state of things. In vain are all attempted at reforms. Men are, it were, chained to unrighteousness by iron fetters. And why? As destiny rules over the activities of children of men, God has given them up to their corrupt ways. Knowledge of God and morality has not altogether ceased. Man still hears proclaimed what is right before God and men. But whatever exists of truth serves only to call forth opposition, to goad men on to do the opposite of what is right. Therefore, men have no excuse. The world is continually driving herself forward to the abyss, to the day of wrath, and the righteous judgment of God. George Stockard writes this thing, and I got the date here, 1862. So I was no, but I can get it for you if you'd like it. I just thought it was an interesting commentary as he reflects through this.
Just a couple of years after Darwin.
Yeah. So if we were to wrap up verse 32 and try to put a bow around it, we could put it there. It tells us that in spite of the knowledge, those with depraved minds not only continue in their vile sins, but they actually approve of others, encourage them to do the same. Knowing the harm that is coming because of their wickedness. Nevertheless, they spread it even the more fully. They invade the fields of education. They dominate the media. They seek legal status for their wickedness. And they defy the attempts of others to try to control and ramp them in. No degree of depravity can be found than the men who cherish evil. Yet that's what they're doing here. It's a grievous aggravation of the offense. And they argue from the highest pitch of moral depravity. It heightens and that they excite others to come join them in their evil practice. Men not only commit this offense alone, but they encourage others to join them. This is not a private practice. This is a practice where they try to take a whole world, joined in hand, they become confederates in iniquity. All social sins are of this class. And the apostle, if you notice these things, were all sins against mankind. They're all social sins. He didn't talk about man sinning against God. He didn't talk about the ungodliness that he opened in 1:18. He talked about the wickedness of man to man. That's what these 21 things are. We would look back on them. They become filled with every type of wickedness, evil, greed, depravity, envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice, gossip, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventing ways to do evil, disobedient to parents, without sense, without faith, without heart, without mercy. Literally, if we're to translate. These are the pictures that we see here. As we conclude our study of verses 24 through 32, I want to make some final observations for you. The charge that the apostle makes here are evident that it was known to them. He doesn't even try to justify it. Almost in every other book, when Paul writes, he gives an example to them. For example, he writes to Timothy, he writes to Titus. And at first, in Titus 1:12, he puts it this way. He says, even one of their own prophets have said, you Cretans, you're always liars, evil brutes, lazy gluttons. And he's just quoting them about what the Cretans say about themselves. He doesn't even bother to quote the Romans to the Romans. Because the Romans know they are these things. The fact that he doesn't even take the paper and to talk about it, to give translators more heartburn or things to have to translate, says it was self-evident. Nobody denies it. It was clearly self-evident. They were confident of it. We talked about that when we looked at it, as we looked at the history of Rome. We looked at Tacitus and Horace and Seneca and Juvenal and how these writers talked about what was going on in Roman society. We had plenty of examples. We weren't short of looking at them. If I remember that Sunday, we went through about 8 or 9 of them. But let me give you one more. We didn't talk about Livy. But Livy writes, we know him as Livy. He's Titus Livius, literally in the Latin, if you were to translate through his Roman name. It says, some have increased by her virtues until now, when we can neither bear our vices nor their remedy. Notice his time frame. Time of Paul. A little bit before. He says, up to this time we've been honorable Romans. But now we are our own vices, our own corruptions. As I mentioned to you, 16 of the first 17 emperors were practicing homosexuals in the Roman Empire. As he writes his history of Rome, he says, we cannot bear the vices nor the remedies. This was in his preface to his book on his history of Rome. Seneca the Younger, a different quote. We talked about Seneca earlier. He, if you remember, was one of the great Roman Stoic philosophers, statesman, dramatist, and a humorist, who writes in the same time frame as Paul. His birth, if I remember correctly, he dies in 65. He's born in 4 BC. So he's a contemporary of Paul. He's out there. He was a tutor to the Emperor Nero. And he writes in his histories, he writes to them on his article on anger. He puts it this way, all is full of criminality and vice. Indeed, much more of these is committed than is remedied by force. A monstrous contest of abandoned wickedness is carried on. The lust of sin increases daily. The shame is daily more and more extinguished. Discarding respect for all that is good and sacred, lust rushes on wherever it will. Vice no longer hides itself. It stalks forth before all eyes. So public was adorned, wickedness becomes. So openly does it flame up in our minds of all that innocence is no longer seldom, but has wholly ceased to exist. This is the culture that Paul writes the book of Romans to. This is the understanding. Furthermore, the authorities of this kind could easily have been found out there. But Paul writes back to them and he says to them, he wants them to understand this is because God has given them over. It's this state of things, if it was clear to them, they needed a new plan for salvation. The plan that they had, man's plan, wasn't working. They needed to go back and maybe listen to God's plan for salvation. So in chapter 1, he opens up, God has a plan, you've suppressed the plan. You don't want to know the plan, but I'm going to tell you, chapter 2 to chapter 6, what that plan is anyway. So Paul is doing his introduction. He's getting through here. It's remarkable that in these charges, the apostle speaks of the most enlightened and refined nation of all antiquity. You ask people, what do you know about Rome? They were the Pax Romana. They were the high point of government. They were the high point of ethical value. And look what their people write about themselves. They were depravity because they had walked away from God. The experiment, whether man could save himself by his own work, had proven itself a failure. Man cannot play Operation Bootstrap and lift himself up. Therefore, there is a need. All the great philosophers of the day came to the conclusion that man could not save himself. And Paul writes to these people and says, but it's not a time of despair. There's good news. There is the gospel of righteousness. There's the gospel that God is showing himself. There is another plan that needs to be given to us. He wants them to understand the state of things in the heathen world is because they are heathens, because they have suppressed the truth, and because they've walked away from it. And he wants them to understand it's not because they're Romans. It's true of all societies. He doesn't write, you Romans are these things. He says, all have sinned and fallen short. The same thing was true in China and India and Africa, the Sandwich Islands, Latin America, North America, the grand USA. It was need for something better than religion. Religion was man's attempt to create and invent God. They needed God's creation of what he wanted to reveal to them. All the infidels and deists have come to the conclusion in their natural religion that they couldn't make it. And God says, good, it's not because you have to make it. I have made it for you. We've played with this pun before in this class, but I want to portray it to you one more time. The difference between churchianity, which is spelled D-O, and Christianity is that it's spelled D-O-N-E. There's nothing you need to do. God has done it for you. He even gives you the grace to accept it. Paul writes to the church in Ephesus. He says, it's for a grace you've saved. And that's not of yourself. It's a free gift to God. God has given you the gift to receive and to understand him. There is a need to move forward, to be children of the light, not children of the darkness. This account in this chapter should give us an excitement for why we should be involved in missions. As Paul judged, so the world is still being judged. How will they know there's light if we don't send light into the darkness? You know, it's interesting. There's not a dark light. I don't turn on darkness. I turn off light. You have to shine the light. We need to go and be testifying of what's going on here. The unsearchable riches of knowing Christ and what he's proclaimed within us is what Paul is trying to do here. He wants them to understand that now in all the nations, there's a new thing. There's Christianity. Christ has come and he wants to proclaim him. And I think it's equally true today. There's a revelation shown in nature who God is, but there's a full revelation of what Christ has done is he provided a new means of salvation. A way that's not spent upon obeying a bunch of rules and regulations. It's not 632 Jewish laws you need to obey. It's receiving the free gift of what God has done for us. This is the doctrine that Paul is going to be building upon. There's nowhere that the Christian church spreads its loving care and its protective wings that we don't see the gospel going forth. When the gospel is the emphasis, Christ says, if I be lifted up, I will draw all men to me. You know, when we go off and we try to solve social welfare and social issues, we fail. But we go with an evangelical, preach the gospel. You know what the great thing happens? Child labor gets taken care of. Woman suffrage gets taken care of. Hospitals get built. Social inequities get dealt with because the gospel speaks out against those things. But when we go trying to present our own Operation Self Bootstrap, we end up in failure. We may end up in abysmal. So let me summarize it this way. If we were to come to a conclusion, summarizing what we've seen in verses 34 through 32, there's sufficient evidence in the world that God exists. So much, in fact, that people are without excuse to conclude otherwise. Rejecting knowledge about God results only in the condemnation. Excuse me, it results not only in condemnation, but it results in corruption. The corruption of the mind occurs because we reject that which is true and we replace it with the lie. This leads to the corruption of the heart in which our desires become corrupt.
because we desire things that are shameful from God's point of view. So we move from that which was natural to that which is unnatural as we look through the text. We no longer do that which is important. Marcus, Cicero. He writes here, virtues done, never thought of being received from deity. He goes on to say, this is the persuasion of all, that fortune is to be. This is persuasion of all, that fortune is to be had from the gods, wisdom from ourselves. You see, man was trying to lift himself up. Cicero writes out there, it's by our own natural thinking. Whoever thanks the gods for being a good man, pray to Jupiter, not that he would make them just, temperate, or wise, but for riches and to be prosperous. This is the idea when they try to suppress the truth. God condemns such thinking. He wants them to understand. Juvenile, in fact, I'm on to next week's lesson, so I'm going to back up. I don't want to talk about these today. The summation that we are corrupt of mind, corrupt of heart, and finally we're corrupt in our conscience, which leads us to the feeling that we no longer feel guilty. This is the problem we've come to. This is the reason for Gentile guilt. With this understanding, next week when we come together, I want to take 18 through 32. I want to take about 15 minutes. I want to spend the rest of class talking about Christmas. We're going to have a fun time. But I want to take the first half of class and try to tie together everything that's been said to date. Because as we leave the thing, I want to try to pick up the pace a little more. Because if we finish the foundation, we finish the laying down of the doctrines that Paul's going to talk about through the rest of the book. And now we're prepared to move through it and read it. And we've spent almost 32 Sundays to date. I believe this is our 32nd Sunday on the book of Romans. And we're at the 32nd verse. It hasn't been a Sunday, a verse. We spent the first nine Sundays just talking about Rome. What was going on in the background, who this Apostle Paul was. But we spent an excessive amount of time. But we are going to pick up. We are going to finish Romans before Jesus comes back. Maybe. And I got news for you. If he wants to come, I'm not going to wait to teach Romans. You can talk to Paul. You can do a better job. Let's pray. Father God, we thank you for this chapter. There's so much in it. From the heart of Paul, as he opens up with a passion, we talk about the deity of Christ, the hypostatic union between 100% God and 100% man, to the compassion that moved him, his obligation, his earnestness, his unashamedness of the gospel. That there is a righteousness that's from God, but there's also an unrighteousness that man brings. Father, we pray that we would not be people who suppress truth, but we would be people of the truth, who proclaim it, who are testimonies in a world who desperately needs to see light. Father, we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Have a great week. Again, next week we will review 18 through 32. I know we spent a lot of time talking about what's Christmas.
So we're going to have a pool on whether it takes 15 minutes. Just joking.
It won't take.